You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. No Mena van Praagh today, I'm afraid. Mena not feeling too good, though she's here in spirit because she's here in an interview with J.S. Watts, a local author that will be broadcasting later in the show. We've also got an interview with Natalia Anderson, who's a poet who's put together the Poetry Extension, which is a virtual bringing together of poets. And we have our studio guest today, Angela Clark, author of Confessions of a Fashionista, but here really to talk about her debut novel, Follow Me. Now, hello, Angela.
Hi, Lee. Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to have you back. You've been on the show before. Friend of the show, we like to say. Well, talking about Natalia there and social media, bringing poets together, and your book very much about social media. It has changed things for writers, hasn't it, social media?
It has. Well, if you think that just a decade ago we didn't really have Facebook or Twitter, and now 15 million people in the UK alone use Twitter, that's a huge new community that's been kind of created and brought together. And because I write crime thrillers, which in particular so many times authors avoid phones, it's always, oh, I've dropped my phone and smashed it, or there's no signal, or things like that, because of course it makes it more complex to have a plot. Because nowadays, if you have any questions raised, what's the first thing you do? Even if you're not a crime detective, you Google to find out the answer. You know, we use our phones for so many things, and social media is such a huge part of that. But I wanted to kind of think about how social media played into the world that we now live, and therefore plays into kind of crime. And what, because obviously in the same way that everyday people use social media, so do criminals. So it was something that I wanted to not avoid, but bring in more to my work instead. So yeah, it's a new frontier for authors, a fun one.
And personally, as an author, it means that you have contact with your readers.
Yeah, it's great. I do love social media for that. I mean, there's a huge community of book readers and bloggers and writers online. Just in the last couple of weeks, I've had a really lovely kind of show of just how great social media can be at bringing people together. There's a writing retreat that I've frequented that I've been to for the last 6 years, and it's down in Devon. And one of the co-partners of the writing retreat sadly, suddenly and unexpectedly died, leaving the other co-partner in a situation where she's at financial kind of risk. She's had to immediately close the retreat, which was their livelihood. And the writing community has come together across social media. You know, we're talking about people who live in Canada, who live in America, who've been to this small little village in Devon, as well as people who obviously are in London, Cambridge, all the other parts of the UK, and have shown this huge outpouring of love and support for these people, for these retreat runners. And I think that's something that social media has really kind of helped us do. Not only does it allow us to share news quickly, even if it's sad news in this case, it also helps us to come together. So there's been a Just Giving page that's been set up, and so many people have given wonderful donations and wonderful tributes on behalf of the retreat owner who passed away.
That's nice to hear a positive story, because normally we hear lots of negative stories about social media and Facebook and Twitter.
I think there are definitely dark sides to social media, and that's something that I've looked at in Follow Me. But I think all too often people don't talk about the positives. I myself have a degenerative connective tissue disorder that's called EDS3 that does sometimes restrict my mobility, and at some times in the past has restricted it greatly. So I haven't been able to really leave the house for about 6 months. When that happens and your world kind of shrinks to your bed, in my case, in my bedroom, which I couldn't leave for weeks on end, it becomes a real lifeline. Social media allows you to still talk to people, to still be social, to still feel like you're part of the world without actually having to leave the space that you're in. And I can see why that works so well for lots of people who are marginalised for whatever reasons, whether you're restricted by mobility or perhaps you're a young person and where you happen to live, your sexuality is not welcome, or you know, your gender identity is not welcome. And all these kind of things, you're able to find people who are the same as you online. You're able to talk to those people. You're able to build friendship groups. You know, one of my best friends now I met on Twitter. And so I think there's lots and lots and lots of positives that people don't necessarily talk about.
Well, good to hear the positives, because we're going to be delving into the darker side of the social media through your novel Follow Me. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. I will give you a proper introduction, but we'll play your first choice of music now, which is Queen, Don't Stop Me Now. Why this one?
Well, this is obviously the lead singer of Queen is Freddie Mercury, and in Follow Me, my lead character, a young woman of 23, is named Freddie after Freddie Mercury.
Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive, and the world I'm turning inside out.
That's Queen, Don't Stop Me Now, the first choice of music of our studio guest today on Bookmark, Angela Clark. Angela's memoir of working in the fashion industry, Confessions of a Fashionista, published in 2013, is an Amazon fashion chart bestseller. Since then, Angela's kept herself busy. Her debut play, The Legacy, received rave reviews after its first run at the Hope Theatre in June last year. The same year, she was awarded the Young Stationers Prize for Achievement and Promise in Writing and Publishing. She continues to contribute to The Guardian, The Independent, The Daily Mail and Cosmopolitan. And as if that wasn't enough, her debut crime novel, Follow Me, was published in December and has been described as chilling, compelling and invigorating. You are a busy lady, Angela. How do you see yourself then? Journalist, playwright, novelist, memoirist?
Well, I always say writer because it kind of encompasses everything, though it doesn't sound quite so exciting. So on my bios online, I list myself as author, columnist and playwright, but really writer does it.
So. Writer does cover it all, isn't it? So how did Follow Me come about? Given that you were doing all these different things, why suddenly move into novel writing?
Well, I'd always wanted to write novels, and I actually, when I first started writing, set out to write a novel and did write a women's commercial fiction novel. And at the point when I finished it, the market wasn't strong enough in order to sell it. So instead, I, under the guidance of my agent, shifted direction and wrote a memoir of my time I spent in the fashion industry. So I wrote Confessions of a Fashionista. But once that was done and out there, though it was lots of fun, my life just isn't really exciting enough to do any kind of follow-on memoir. I'm afraid, you know. So I returned to what was my first love, which was writing stories. And I actually started to write a young adult novel, first of all, one that was set around a fashion blogger. And unfortunately, during that time when I was writing that, my EDS flared and I had a very bad period of time where I couldn't work for about 6 months. I managed to dislocate my neck. Not recommended. Oh, don't do that. during that 6 months, I was unable to work. And if you're a writer, you probably understand that if you overthink a book, if you think constantly about the story but never write anything, never actually get any words down, which I couldn't do. I wasn't able to type or write. Then it kind of becomes this big, huge thing. And the book basically imploded in my head. I couldn't get back to it. And also, I'd changed in that period of time. I'd been restricted in what I could do, and that had made me, well, depressed, for want of a better word. And it made my edges darker. So it seemed much more fitting to write something that was a bit bleaker and a bit sort of shadowy. So I started writing a crime thriller. Though I have to admit, I didn't set out to write a crime thriller. I set out to write about the internet. And then people kept dying, so it ended up being crime. So
it's very shadowy. Give us a brief resume of the plot for people who haven't read it.
Sure. Well, Freddie Venton is my lead. She's your average millennial in the sense that she works in a coffee shop, which may or may not be Starbucks, in St Pancras Station in order to pay the bills, to live in a living room in a shared flat in Dalston. She sleeps on a sofa, generation rent, obviously. And she is desperate to be a journalist, but she's writing for lots and lots of online articles, which means she gets paid very little or sometimes nothing at all. Taking advice perhaps dodgy advice from a more kind of mentor journalist in her life, she decides to seize the story. And when she sees an old school friend, Nazreen Cudmore, that she hasn't seen for a number of years, but who she knows as a police officer, she decides to follow her and investigate the crime scene where a crime has taken place. So she dresses as a CSI and breaks into the crime scene and realises that it's a murder, and that the murder victim has actually been trolling at the time of their death. From that point, she becomes involved in the police investigation. This is based partially on fact. I did a lot of research for the book, and the police are quite obviously dissuaded from using social media. There are lots of problems that you can easily see if you have police people with active Facebook or Twitter accounts or things like that. You know, you don't want them to share where they are. You don't want them to share case sensitive information. You don't want people to be able to find them, etc. But what that means is that there is a gap between their understanding of social media and their understanding of how people use it. And I thought that was quite an interesting place to put a story. So through one means and another, Freddie gets hired as a social media consultant on this case. And this case turns out to be that of the hashtag murderer. There's basically a serial killer who's tweeting clues on Twitter about who his next victim's going to be.
Tweeting clues and tweeting pictures. Yeah, so let's talk about Freddie, because in one of the reviews I saw her described as monstrous. She's quite interesting. Do you want your reader to like her? I mean, presumably you do, but she's quite hard to like sometimes.
I like Freddie, and I think she's quite misunderstood, but a lot of people don't like her. A lot of people find her very Marmite. To me, she's very opinionated. She's quite idealistic. She's quite young. Still, she's only 23. And she is very kind of idealistic with her politics and her views on society. But she's very driven and ambitious as well. But I think some people see some of her actions as flippant or selfish even.
Quite reckless
at times. Yeah, she can be. She definitely can be. She's a bit of a kind of jump in feet first kind of girl. But I like her. I like her kind of mouthy politics. I feel like I know a lot of women like Freddie. And I always find it interesting when readers say they don't like her, because I do wonder, and this is perhaps a slightly loaded thing to say, but I do wonder if it was a male protagonist, if she was a guy, if they would say that. And perhaps we're more used to having more challenging male characters than we are female characters, especially young female characters. We expect them to want to please. We expect them to want to play nice, you know, to do all of those kind of things. And really, Freddie has no interest in doing that.
Well, the female characters in the book are very strong. There's Freddie, there's Nazreen, you mentioned, who's also, you know, a very puddly mobile Asian police officer, very ambitious, very, very clever. And then there's the guys in the police force. They're not quite life on Mars, but they are a little bit outdated. Yeah. Did you do some research? Are they based on people you researched?
Well, I did do quite a lot of research, and I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But I think that when you have an institution that is largely male dominant and it has a particular kind of culture to it, I think there are elements of that sort of boys club culture, and that sort of, therefore you take the mickey out of everybody regardless of who they are or what you're taking the mickey out of. And I suppose I kind of wanted to echo that, and I wanted to bring into contrast this idea of Nazreen in particular, you know, this young ambitious woman trying to make her way in a world and trying to prove herself when perhaps other people might see her as something different. In a way, because she's very attractive, I think that's a disadvantage for her as a policewoman. I think it would probably be better if she was a bit less striking, if that makes sense.
The idea of a murderer posting the clues to who they're going to murder next on Twitter and then posting the evidence that they've done it. When I read it, I thought, has anybody done this? Because it's one of those things when you read, you think, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Is it based on anything?
It isn't, but obviously since it's happened, I mean, there have been a number of kind of social media related crimes. So there was a killer on Gumtree who bought something and it was a scam, and they built a pipe bomb and sent it back to the person that they bought it from. There was also the case, I think it was in Germany, where there was a cannibal who advertised over Gumtree for somebody to eat And that actually took place. He then murdered the person and cut bits off them and ate them. There are kind of things like that. But there haven't actually been so far, touch wood, anybody who's tweeted photos. The closest we've come to it is after the book was actually published, or just when it was coming out. There was the case in America of the disgruntled guy who shot a news anchor woman when she was live on air, and then the cameraman, and he live tweeted that and actually had a live stream through from his Twitter account. It was an American case and Twitter immediately shut it down.
Right. I mean, there's lots about Twitter in the novel and about the rules around Twitter and how far it goes. We will come back and explore that. But we're going to talk now to a Cambridge-based novelist, J.S. Watts. She's a novelist and poet. Her novels Witchlight and Darker Moon are published by Vagabondage Press. This month sees the publication of her new poetry collection, Years Ago You Coloured Me, which contains award-winning poetry. Both combine magical realism and humour. And when Mena Van Praagh met her, she asked Jacqueline if the combination was always intended.
Yes, I wanted to write something that was lighter and that was serious but didn't take itself too seriously, if that makes sense. So, humour's important to me, and I'd like sometimes to look at the darker side of life with a touch of humour peppered in, because I've got a rather crooked black sense of humour anyway, so it flows naturally.
Do you find that comes naturally to you? Because it read very naturally.
I think, yeah, it does come naturally. I mean, I can write very straight and very dark if I want to. But yeah, because I have a naturally slightly quirky sense of humour, if I just kind of relax into it, it does come naturally. And once I've decided that that's the tone of the book, the humour occurs to me as I write on through. So, yeah.
Because not to give any spoilers away, but it does get very dark at the end.
It does, yes. I suppose that's how I find life, that life has its dark patches and its light patches. Sometimes you can combine it. So I don't have a problem with mixing the humour as a contrast to the dark, because it actually heightens the dark when you get there. If you're doom and gloom all the way through, perhaps that doesn't add the crescendo at the end that it's sometimes nice to have.
So have you always been drawn to magical writing?
I've done lots of other stuff, but yes, I think it's always been there. And I think it was there before I was a writer, whenever that was, when I was a reader, because if I think back, and I think back to my childhood, when I was allowed at the library, the books I loved, apart from Orlando the Marmalade Cat, which was favourites when I was very young, was I liked books about myths and legends. So it was always, let me have another book about myths of whatever continent or country I could grab hold of. So I've always been fascinated by fairy tales and myth. I wasn't conscious as a child of it being genre, so you read something that's myth, like Rosemary Sutcliffe's Cahula and the Hound of Ulster, which is based on Irish myth. To me, it was just a really compelling, powerful tale. And then I carried on reading, I discovered Ray Bradbury, and it wasn't till adulthood I thought, oh, they're technically genres, they divide. So that fascination with the fantastical has always been there. And therefore, again, it's natural when I've written that when I write things that are important to me, the fantastical sometimes creeps in as well. Although I write science fiction, I write horror, I write straight literary fiction that has nothing fantastical or magical at all. It's whether the story needs it or not, I guess, that it goes in.
Do you find then that you can write all different genres in terms of publication, or do your publishers want to fit you into one genre?
In terms of what I write, I can write any genre, and what I really like doing is mixing genres. I like combination of horror and fantasy, or psychological horror and dark and mythical stuff. So I've just written what I've wanted to write. But I do find when it comes to the publishing side of things, for a while I struggled, certainly with the two novels, to find a publisher, because they said, lovely story. Oh, but it's kind of a bit of a hybrid, isn't it? Because the first novel was like, well, it's horror and it's psychological and it's myth and it's fantasy. And good luck with that.
Yeah, how will we market this?
Yeah, and I clocked up a huge pile of rejections. Some really encouraging, but often it was like, oh, we don't do cross-genre, and yet how do we market it? And in fact, the publisher of my two novels, Vagabondage Press, went out there saying, we want books that cross boundaries, that don't fit in pigeonholes, but are about human life. But if you come at human life through fantasy or whatever, that's great by us. And I thought, that's kind of what I've done. I'll just try. And they went, yay, that's what we're looking for. But they'd actually said, we don't want to compartmentalise, we want to be different. And similarly, because I write short stories as well, and you find that with magazines, that, again, some stories happily fit into boxes because that's how they needed to be written in my head. the one or two stories, and one I really love, I still haven't found a magazine slot for it, because you keep wandering it around and go, yeah, it's nice, but it was a bit too magic for us. But it's really literary fiction. But so, yeah, cross-genre writing has its problems, but it's what I like writing and it's what I like reading.
And poetry?
It's all storytelling in one form or another. Even the poetry is storytelling, albeit in a condensed format.
So has it always been poetry that you've written?
Poetry was there just before the short stories, although if I try and think back to how long I've been writing, and it's one of those embarrassing things, I think, gosh, I have been writing since I was knee-high to grasshopper, and I'm not that tall now. So I'd say, I can remember my first poetry success must have been last year of infant school, first year of junior school, when I came second in a local poetry competition. I think poetry did come on very early, but yes, I was just like writing things, and I did write short stories. Again, as I grew older and wrote more seriously, poetry had the edge, because it's sometimes easier to sit down and write a poem than it is to sit down and write a story or indeed a novel. So when I first came out of university, I was writing poetry quite a lot, and spent some time getting published in the literary magazines. And then the day job took over, but I still kept writing poetry, because it's something you can use at a bus stop and jot something down and sit in the bath writing things, building up a body of work. And then you think, perhaps I want to see if I can get published beyond the literary mags. And around about that time, my work situation changed, and I had an opportunity to step out. But I'll do this for a year. I will see if I can have a book in me. I'll give it a go. And I'll see if I can earn enough money to either make a living totally as a writer, or at least kind of mix it with freelancing. That was 8 years ago now. And yes, now we're 5 books on. So eventually got back into writing, and that gave me the time to go back into short stories and to tackle those novels and see if I could do it. The poetry's been there the longest, simply because of the time constraints, but the urge to do fiction's always been there as well. And
back to Witchlight. Did you have a favourite character?
I had a number of favourite characters. I'm not going to differentiate. I love writing Partridge, but I liked Holly as well. Holly is the closest of the characters I've ever written that's close to me, in that she's short and slightly acerbic and bad-tempered, which can be me on a bad day. So I like writing Holly. But yes, Mayflower was fun to write as well.
Do you find sometimes it's fun to write the baddies?
Yes. I like a character I can get my teeth into, and that might be someone like Partridge, who starts off very fey and avuncular, although has a slightly darker side to him as well. Or it could be, yes, writing a baddie. As long as they've got depth, and even baddies, well, there's the issue of how do they get bad and how bad can you make them? And I like a character that challenges me to write but keeps me occupied while I'm writing them.
What does your writing day look like?
I'll be honest, like most writers, I'm not rolling in the lap of luxury, so I do some consultancy work on the side. So most mornings is when I do the consultancy work. So my writing day will probably start about 1:30, do the admin side of things. So mid-afternoon I'll get started, and it really depends what I'm working on. If I'm working on a novel, then that could be just the rest of the day, writing, making notes, editing as I go along. And if I'm on a roll, then it will go into the evening, and if I'm really on the roll, it'll go into the early hours of the morning. If it's a short story or a poem, I may then need to get away from it, even take a walk out for an hour or so, and then come back and revisit and work on it again.
Do you like to plot, or are you what they call a pantsier? You fly by the seat of your pants.
Half and half. I'll start off with an idea. From that, I will plan to a certain extent. So I'll have worked out probably the lead characters. I'll have worked out where I think I'm going to finish. Cause I do tend to write novels in a linear fashion. I tend to write through rather than dotting around between chapters. I may have identified key parts within the story, and then I'll start writing. And then when I'm a chapter or two in and the story starts to unroll for me, then I go back and plan some more, and then I write. But what I do find as I write, it changes. So although I've got this lovely plan, halfway through I may find that character A, who I really thought was going to rush off to Bridge North and drive trains for a living, suddenly decides that, yeah, they want to be an artist and do something else. The plan's there, but I do deviate from the plan, because as the story develops, it tells me where it needs to go. That's when I know that the story has got air in its lungs, because it's breathing for itself and it's telling me where it's going. If I have a story, and I've had them before now, where I've got the plan and the story goes plonkety, 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 plonk, and just follows the plan, the story is as flat as a pancake. There's no air in it. It's not breathing.
What's up for you next?
I am working on a sequel to Witchlight, but I have been working on a sequel to Witchlight for rather a little while. So I'm just a little bit careful about talking about it, but I'd like to bring it to conclusion.
Well, I'm excited to hear that, because the way it ended, it wasn't that you left us wanting too much more in the sense that you feel cheated, but you did leave us wanting more in the sense of, yeah, I could return to those characters and see what's going on with them.
Has been likened to Harry Potter for grown-ups. I don't know if that's true, but it is that you discover you're a witch, you've got magical powers, but normally you do it when you're 10 or you're 14. And I thought, well, what happens if you're late 30s and you start discovering? It kind of throws your world upside down. So I wanted to balance, before, the magical alongside reality. I didn't want to come to the end and do the "and they all lived happily ever after" and tie it up in a bow, because that's too fantastical. That real life isn't like that. There's always that, well, what happens next? Because even when you come to the end of a chapter, metaphorically in terms of life, if you go on living, it's not the end of the road. So naturally, it felt there should be possibilities of what happens next.
That's J.S. Watts there talking to Mena Van Praagh. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is novelist Angela Clark, talking about her first in the Social Media Murders series. Novelist says, no pressure, follow me. Jacqueline there talking about writing the baddies and enjoying writing the baddies. That's quite difficult when you're writing crime, isn't it? Because we're not supposed to know who the baddies are, the reader.
No. I mean, are there obviously some kind of... some books that have played with that and done mid-twists. But yes, it would be difficult to write from the point of view of a baddie unless it's part of your very clever plot structure.
You must be very conscious when you're writing a crime novel of your reader trying to second guess and work out what's red herrings. It's an interesting relationship you have with the text reading a crime novel, because you're always liking to think that you're one step ahead of the writer, and presumably the writer wants to think they're one step ahead of the reader.
I think it's very difficult if you're a writer to read crime and or indeed any book and not see plot twists coming. In a way, it's harder if the writer is very good, I find, if they don't have any spare flabby sentences, and then there's suddenly a sentence that doesn't seem to fit. You automatically go, well, there must be a reason for that. That must be a plot thing. And I was aware of that when I was writing. But I think it's best to just get on with it, really, and kind of hope for the best when it comes out. And if people don't work out who it is, and several people have sent messages going, oh my god, no, about the ending, which I love. That's probably my favorite thing, I think, about writing it. If you can pull that final flourish at the end, that's worth it.
And how did you plot it? Did you know right at the beginning how it was going to end, who'd done it?
I did know right at the beginning who'd done it. I tend to have about sort of 8 key plot points, and then I fill in the gaps between them. So things can change between those points. Like Jacqueline said, often a character will go off and do something that is unexpected or you weren't expecting them to do. And I always think in that situation, that's because I've plotted those 8 points, but it's not me in the story. It's a different person, and they react differently than how I would to different things. So I think it's that unfurls.
And we'll talk more about unfurling in the next half hour or so, but we're going to play your second track of music now, which is Push a Little Button by Nanette. Why this one?
Well, I think if you're talking about social media and you're talking about computers and phones, you've got to have something that references buttons.
You push a little button and you get hot chocolate. Push a little button and you get some tea. The world's gone.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Sorry about that very brutal ending to the Nanette track there. I didn't push a little button there, but something went wrong in the recording, but you got the gist of that. Welcome back to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today is Angela Clark. Angela, you're going to read an extract from Follow Me Now.
I am. Ready?
Yes, go for it.
5:35 a.m, Saturday the 31st of October. From where she stood in the doorway of the bedroom of 39 Blackbird Road, London, E14, Freddie could see blood. A lot of blood. The plastic overall she was wearing rustled in time with her clipped, panicked breaths. The blue walls were splattered with red, as if a food fight had taken place with thin, runny little ketchup. But it wasn't tomato sauce. She could taste it. Metallic. It was coating her tongue. Sweat stuck clumps of thick, frizzy hair to her forehead, loosened her glasses on her nose, and opened her pores to the gore. She was absorbing it. Dread pinpricked her skin. The sauce was to her right, shielded by the open room door. There was still time to leave, to turn back, to run. She could be home in 30, pretend none of this had happened. Heavy footsteps fell on the stairs behind her. More people were coming. She had to decide. Seize the story. It was now or never. Opportunity follows struggle. Fear makes you braver. Despite deriding the inspirational quotes that appear over photos of sunsets and ocean, and the ocean on Facebook, Freddie was disappointed to discover that when she reached her own life crossroads, her brain filled with nothing but clichés. To shut herself up, she stepped forward. Reassuring herself, it was just like the movies. You've seen it all before. The time she'd had to lie down after watching a beheading video online didn't count. This was different. She was prepared. She turned. The floor undulated under Freddie's feet. The body of what had once been a man was slumped over a desk, his net cut like deli salami, blood pooling round his bare feet. A computer, its wormhole screensaver winding over the monitor, seemed to propel blood toward her. The last thing she heard before the dark red obliterated everything was her childhood friend Nazreen Cudmore's voice. Freddie Venton, what the hell are you doing here?
Thank you for that. That's very near the beginning of the novel, isn't it?
It is.
Writing those, it's because it's not a gory novel.
No.
But you have to get the idea that what's been happening here, what's been done is really horrible. Don't we want to catch this woman, this man, whoever.
Yeah, and there needs to be a certain amount of kind of gritty realism to it. And especially when you're in Freddie's point of view, because she's not a professional, she's not a police officer, she's just like you and me. And if you and me stumbled across a murdered person, I think we'd be quite traumatised by it and it would be quite shocking. So yes, it's not a gore fest, but there is the need to kind of give that feeling of kind of fear and terror and the horror of the situation to the reader.
I like that because she is in shock for quite a lot of the book over the things that she sees. In terms of social media, obviously, in some ways it opens it up and the serial murderer uses Twitter, etc. Does it also close it down, but make it more difficult in the sense that it's very hard to keep secrets on social media, in terms of writing, and in a book, and a novel, in a crime novel in particular, you want secrets. You know, how did you deal with that side of things?
Well, I mean, it's something that the police have to deal with nowadays in real life. Very recently, we saw it with the Paris attacks. They had to put out a block on people's phones because people were tweeting what was happening in real time. They were tweeting that there was armed police going into, for example, the supermarket that was under siege. Potentially giving a heads up to the hostage takers that were inside. So it's something that I'm kind of painfully aware that you have to counter, and that's something that I've tried to put into the book. There is a part where the police are they make an arrest, and the whole thing is caught on other people's smartphones and shared. So instead of it being something keeping it close and hidden and kind of unrealistic nowadays, I wanted to kind of think about what was the impact of that on an investigation, because there are no secrets. You can't keep anything close to your chest anymore. You can't withdraw your cards. And in this situation, you have a murderer who is manipulating social media and the media in order for them to make the most of the situation. And in doing so, of course, it helps them stay one step ahead of the police.
Right. Well, we're going to come back to you again. It's talking about social media now, though. We're going to speak to Natalia Anderson. Natalia completed an MA in creative writing at Anglia Ruskin University. Her poem Clear Recent History won the prestigious Bridport Prize in 2014, and her poetry has appeared in a variety of anthologies. She recently returned to her native Canada and subsequently founded the Poetry Extension to bring together poets from around the world. When I spoke to her down the line from Toronto, I asked her to tell me more about the project.
The Poetry Extension came about mainly, strangely, out of sort of a home sickness for England on my part, which doesn't make a lot of sense because Canada and Toronto specifically is my home. But I lived in Ireland and then the UK for nearly 10 years post graduating from university. And I ended up studying creative writing, did my master's degree at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge. After quite a long time feeling lost in the UK and missing Canada, I found the creative writing program and found poetry. I began to really study it, and it became kind of a grounding force for me. Then, just as I began to feel at one with the UK, my husband was granted an opportunity in Toronto, Canada, and we had the opportunity to move back here, which was exciting and wonderful and heartwarming, but also bittersweet, because then by that time I had found I was really interested in the poetry scene, for lack of a better word, and quite a few poets who had become sort of a saving grace. So when I got back to Toronto, I started to become worried that I would lose these poets in the UK and in Ireland, and why didn't anyone here know who these people were, who were quite celebrated in the UK? And I found that a lot of us just didn't know each other, which is okay, but I thought, what a shame that we don't know each other a bit better.
So it's a kind of virtual bringing together of poets for a poetry reading. It's like a concert, only virtually. Is that what it is?
Yes, I'd say that's a good comparison and kind of a way for us to get to know each other. And it'll actually be visual as well. We're going to have a link on the poetry extension, which is thepoetryextension.com. You'll be able to see a screen of the first reader, and they'll have the largest section of the screen, and then we'll have some smaller screens there visibly on the side of the other poets waiting for their turn to read, and then they'll be zoomed in, and then the other one will zoom out. It's all very technically very
it is
difficult for me to understand in my poetry ballet mind,
because it is very technical, because all these poets are around the world, so you're sort of bringing them in from the UK, from Canada, so technically it is quite challenging.
Fortunately, I'm grateful to the poets who have already done this in transatlantic readings via Skype, because it gives me a little bit of a template to work with. We are working with 9 poets this first event, but I like that we're doing that because it just gives it a bit of a burst through the door. I do have a lineup for our second event, which will include some poets from Ireland.
And why is it important to you that this event takes place live, as it were? Because you could just get each of these poets to record something and then put it on a website that people can tap into. What is it about that live experience that brings something extra?
I think that it's important to have a bit of a challenge when it comes to any art form. It's about performance. It's about creating a bit of electricity and something unexpected and something maybe frightening happening all at once. Live performance in conjunction with any art brings the best of that out. Most of us would say we write to reconcile a lot of the terrors or the traumas or the fears. And some of those can be quite joyous once they're out there in art form, even though some of them can still remain dark or bleak when we read out the words. But to add the live performance is a bit of an electric current. It also has that nice poetry extension element to it, as if we're all on a call connecting to each other, saying, hey, I can't sleep tonight, I've got this poem on my mind, or I've got this worry and it's an awful worry and I can't seem to shake it. How about we talk about it or read about it or write about it or have a live poetry reading in which we maybe tumble over our words and make huge mistakes, but it's still better than sitting there having the fear.
And for the poets themselves, it's a unique experience because they are able to connect at once with other poets around the world in a way that perhaps they wouldn't have been able to, and see them and hear them speak and hear their words.
Absolutely. Art of any kind is often seen as something that is fluffy or pretty or deep and dark, or oh, what a mess that person is, or aren't they profound? Poetry and any kind of written word or form of artistic expression is what connects us all in so many ways, in so many walks of life. And this kind of thing is, I believe, necessary to keep us going. I mean, to be able to connect to people from different countries, to be able to promote the idea that that's a healthy thing to do through art, and not just something that is frilly and fluffy and that's nice, you wrote a little poem. This can be a saving grace to connect to each other so so instantly. It does feel like something that's not just a live thing, but is alive. And I think that's really important.
So how do you choose the poets who are going to be on each event, as it were? Do you go on a theme or are you looking for variation?
For this initial event, I was just looking for people who I connected with over the course of my studies, who were open to, I guess, this kind of thing themselves. So for me, the initial theme is kind of the connection itself, the extension. So even in the title of the event, the poetry extension. And these are poets who have extended themselves to me, or I have to them, over the past 3 years now. All of the poets in our first event have been wonderful. They really want people to write better poetry, and they embrace the idea of teaching that and encouraging that. So the theme for me was mostly just that feeling of wanting to keep connected with these poets.
I suppose if you're a poet, you're thinking what poems to read, if you've been asked to read on the poetry extension. The fact that you're going to be a box in somebody's screen who might be in a completely different environment and country to yourself, it's quite a nice thing to play with, isn't it, in terms of choosing what poems you put out there?
Yeah, I like that idea. You know, I thought it's interesting you asked about theme, because in my head, I keep going back to the idea of home, because that for me is the genesis of all of this. And I think that we probably write about home or paint about home or talk about home a lot in our daily expressions in different ways, because it's where we're from. But I do like what you say about the idea that we'll each be reading from our homes. Some of us in our pajamas, if we're in the UK. We had a joke going that the UK poets would be in their fuzzy slippers and pajamas. I'm interested to see what poems they'll select, because I've kind of left it as a choice for everyone, and what they'll choose to kind of beam out there from their screen and what will become of it. I'm sure it will be a mishmash, but I like that too.
So what are your ambitions for the poetry extension? Where would you like to see it going?
I try to align my poetic ambitions with a 12-step program in my mind, one day at a time, because sometimes I can feel all sorts of fears and worries that can really tangle me up about the future of it and the future in general. My hope is that we will do more and then perhaps narrow our focus into different themes. I'd love to have more poets from my hometown of Toronto come forward and do more. I'd love to have a few more Irish poets. So I hope to move from just screen beaming into some partially live readings with the dance element. If we do earn funding over the next year or so, it'd be wonderful.
That's Natalia Anderson there talking about the poetry extension. And as she said, there's going to be the first poetry extension on the 31st of March. If you want to tune into that, it's poetryextension.com. And that will feature Cambridge-based poet Caddy Bennion. Tickets for that event on the 31st of March are available from Eventbrite. I'm in the studio with our guest on Bookmark, Angela Clark. I thought it was interesting there what Natalia touched on. She said, we write to recognise traumas and fears. That's particularly true in crime, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I was thinking that as well, how much she was speaking the truth about writing, about that fear, and to kind of recognise what's out there. For me, as I said, I started to write Follow Me actually about the internet and about the relationship that I saw people having with the internet, and in particular with regards to trolling and why people trolled, and how I think often there are many other reasons, but often it's because people forget that there is somebody real on the other side of the internet. And I wanted to take that to an extreme. So the extreme in this case was that there is a murderer on the other side, that there is a real person who is going to be killed by in response to your interactions to the internet. And I think that for a lot of people, there is fear surrounding social media, whether it comes from a place of trolling or whether it comes just from the fact that technology is developing so fast, we haven't quite caught up with it socially. We haven't quite built social norms around it. We don't quite know what we're doing yet. We haven't built etiquettes. We haven't sometimes built laws. I mean, we're only just now talking about anti-trolling laws being brought in and more kind of things for the police to do to counter what is basically harassment online.
It has unleashed this kind of darker side of humanity, isn't it, that we wouldn't normally see. I mean, you've only got to look through famous people's Twitter feeds to see the abuse that they get. You know, they're not doing anything wrong, a lot
yeah.
of them.
Yeah, I find it quite staggering. What I find concerning is what came first was that hatred and anger there already, and has social media just given it a platform, shone a light on it, or has social media fed it in some way? I think I probably tend towards the former. I have no reason for that, to think that. But there is something about the online community that seems to bring out the bully in people.
And has it made you more careful about using social media? I mean, you must have done research into this. Has it made you think twice?
It probably hasn't. I've always been fairly sort of careful about what I post. I'm very strict about I won't post particularly where I am at any place of time. Often I have a 24-hour delay if I'm posting pictures. If I've been to a bar or a restaurant, I'll do it 24 hours later. That comes from personal experience that I had previously, where I encountered issues with a stalker, and I'm just a tiny bit more cautious about what I put out there and what I kind of share. I also think as well that for a lot of authors and a lot of people generally, though you can make friends online and you form good, strong friendships, and I know people who met their partners, the people who've gone on to marry online, and by which I mean in social media, not on an online dating site. You know, despite all of those things, I think there is an element, and you should think of this as an author, that it is some part of your brand, even though that sounds like a horribly tacky thing to say. But it shouldn't, you shouldn't put all your dirty washing out online. You're giving too much away if you're doing that. You know, you need to kind of maintain a level of professionality. You can still be friendly and honest and open and transparent, but you know, I think you need to kind of remember that you're not sure who is able to look at those things and kind of keep that.
And particularly if you're a woman as well, because yeah. there's a lot of, you know, the body shaming that goes on and the personal criticism that goes on that women in particular seem to be the focus of.
Well, I think that's why we've seen sort of the fifth wave of feminism come up from social media, kind of unify against that. It seems to have, and again, it goes back to which came first. Was there this dark underside there already, and social media's just shown a light on it? Was there this dark underside of misogyny, and social media's just shown a light on it? Or has it in some way fed it? And again, I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But yes, if you're a woman, and again, it seems to be the higher the profile that you have, the more abuse that you get. I've been unlucky enough to suffer a few days worth of trolling. Nothing as horrific as, say, Caroline Criado Perez, who did the banknotes campaign to keep a woman on the banknotes, suffered, which was weeks and weeks, months and months of harassment. But just a short period of time of being trolled and threatened, you know, with rape or death or various other kinds of things. It's frightening. It's truly terrifying to kind of go through that, because you don't know who's making those threats. You know, there is no context of often when people are confronted or questioned about it, they say, oh no, I don't mean that. My mates will tell you that, you know, I don't mean that. But you know, you don't have that context on the internet. You don't know who is saying that they want to do these horrible violent acts to you, so therefore you know, there's nothing to kind of reassure yourself from, and it can be a dark place.
Well, back to Follow Me. It is advertised as the first in the social media murder series. So are there going to be more?
There are, yes. The next one is called Are You Awake? And it's coming out on October the 10th.
And that, is that going to plug into social media as well?
It is. There is a strong plot line that revolves around Snapchat and revenge porn.
Right, OK. There's plenty to keep you going out there, isn't there?
There is.
Just a brief touch on Confessions of a Fashionista, which you came in to talk to us about a couple of years ago now. Are you still in touch with that fashion world?
I have a number of friends who I've obviously kept in touch with from the fashion world. But apart from that, no, I've probably gone further and further away from it. Apart from the odd kind of catch up with them and a continuing interest in nice clothes, you're more likely to find me in my pyjamas now and out of touch with the latest issue of Vogue.
And no inclination to return then?
I think I kind of, in publishing a memoir that sort of told lots of secrets about the industry,
yes.
sort of burnt my bridges
yes.
on that regard.
Yes. Point taken. And we mentioned the legacy there at the beginning, the play that was at the Hope Theatre. Any more plans to write anything for the stage?
Yes, I'd like to. I'd like to very much. I'm working on a screenplay as well at the moment. But with two more books coming, and there will be another one next year, that has to be my main focus.
But the legacy was based on a real life event, wasn't it? I mean, you took that and you that was black humour, but it was also addressing serious issues.
Yes, it was inspired by the case in America where the Columbia student who had complained that she'd been assaulted by a fellow student, she'd been raped by a fellow student, and felt that her case was not treated well by the university, carried her mattress, the mattress she was assaulted on, to classes and lectures for the rest of her term time. It was a performance arts piece as part of her thesis. And it spread. I mean, it captured the imagination of not just the other students who would help her carry the mattress and, you know, the metaphor for what that meant. But also it resonated, I think, across campuses in America, across campuses here and across the world for lots of reasons. That that kind of accusation of sexual assault being dismissed or not taken seriously, I think hit home with a lot of people.
Thank you. Well, do you class yourself as a crime writer now, then? We to just go back to go full circle. I know you say you're a writer. Would you go further down? Would you subgenre that?
Would I subgenre it? I mean, yes, I suppose I am a crime writer because I'm writing crime. But not everything, other than my next couple of books will be crime. Not everything I write is crime. Having said that, my screenplays ended up having a murder in it as well. So
I think when you go, it's a slippery slope, isn't it? When you go down,
just
that
like
route.
Bumping people off. Yes.
There's always an opportunity to get another body. Thank you, Angela. It's been lovely to talk to you. Do tune in to the next Bookmark. Our studio guest then is Ruth Sker. Ruth's a writer, historian, and literary critic. And we'll be talking to her about her pioneering biography of the father of English biography, John Aubrey. So we'll be talking all things biographical on the next one. We'll also have interviews with Jeff Andrews about his book, The Shadow Man, which looks at James Klugman. He was the man who recruited MacLean, Burgess, and various other Cambridge spies. And we'll also be chatting to Kathy Moore. She's director of the Cambridge Literary Festival. We're finding out what's coming up there. But we'll finish now, Angela, with your last choice of music, which is Land of a Thousand Dances by Wilson Pickett. Why this one?
It just makes me happy.
Oh, that's as good a reason as any. Thank you again.
One, two, three. One, two, three.